From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Yep, Friday night into Saturday morning. Open lines later tonight. By the way, congratulations. They're getting married on Saturday tomorrow. Ashley and Justice, congratulations to you both. Here's what's happening. And happy birthday, by the way, to Tom Danheiser's fiancée, Raquel. Can't forget that. And when it comes to cloudy, rainy days, Portland, Oregon ranks high among U.S. cities. But even with all the moisture, the city's water supply is not safe to drink, according to authorities. Listen to this. Boy, I just came back from Portland. The Portland Water Bureau has urged about 670,000 people in its region to boil water they drink, that they use to make food or ice, that they brush their teeth with after three tests have come back positive for E. coli bacteria. Now, the first sign of the trouble came Wednesday when a routine sample taken the previous day tested positive for E. coli. Then they did a few more tests. They came back clean, and then they took some more samples. Two of them did not. What a mess. A lot of residents out there really ticked off. If you haven't heard by now, Monsanto is not exactly the most popular company in the world these days. They're responsible for a large portion of the GMO seed in this country. And considering all of the recent bouts to get GMO foods labeled, Monsanto is at the top of the list for the anti-GMO activist. For these reasons, March Against Monsanto, a global event involving a whopping six continents, 400 cities, and 52 countries, are slated to hold a march happening this weekend on Saturday in the U.S. So far, 47 states will hold events. Founded by Tammy Monroe Cannell as a response to the failure of California's Proposition 37, the first march against Monsanto took place in May of last year with estimates of hundreds of thousands of people in attendance. An estimated 350 events took place on the first march day. A second event took place October of 2013, and judging from the roster, they say, of 400 cities for this march, this event is growing with each march. Monday night, by the way, on Memorial Day, the first couple hours, GMO expert Jeffrey Smith joins us. We'll talk about the march and GMOs. A frightening incident of vandalism in El Paso near the Mexican border in Texas. Two of us, as a matter of fact, have been interpreted as warnings from drug cartels. In both instances, a mannequin wearing a suit and a tie was tied to a billboard with a noose and messages that were scrawled over the placards. One of the signs reads, Plata o Plomo, which translates to silver or lead. It's a threat commonly used against police officers, effectively warning that if they do not accept the cartel's bribes, then they will be shot. A growing problem in this country. And that's, of course, when we had Judge Jim Gray on last night, where he talked about legalization. That would avoid some of this, wouldn't it? Even the calmest drivers have experienced an occasional moment of road rage at the hands of a rude or inconsiderate motorist. But what's most likely to set off the drivers? Well, according to a new study now by the travel site Expedia, some of the most rage-inducing behaviors are slowpokes who don't move out of the way, tailgaters, and people who text while driving. The U.S. has suspended $3.5 million in military aid to Thailand and urged the country's army to restore civilian rule immediately. Washington also urged tourists to cancel trips and halted non-essential visits by U.S. government officials. Let's check in with the expert, Jerome Corsi, his latest work, Hunting Hitler. I want to get a roundup from Jerry on world events. But first of all, your thoughts on the Thailand situation, Jerry?
Well, the Thailand situation is definitely a coup. The military has taken over. And Thailand's a very complicated situation, multiple religions, multiple different ideologies. The United States is opposing the coup, but I think the coup is going to be successful, and I don't think there's much the United States can do to stop it.
No, and what's the Ukraine situation these days, Jerry?
Well, the Ukraine, Russia seems to be getting what it wants without having any military intervention. I mean, there's going to be a presidential election coming up, you know, imminently. This weekend it's being organized. And eastern Ukraine really seems already under the control of Russia with revolutionary groups that are very pro-Russian. So even if there is a Ukrainian president elected who's favorable to the West and NATO, I don't think that president would be able to do very much without Russia's approval, and Russia will never approve Ukraine moving into NATO.
All right, Jerry, you have yourself a great Memorial weekend, okay?
And George, to you, your staff, and to all listeners, have a great Memorial Day weekend. Thank you.
Jerry Corsi. Information on Jerry, of course. He writes for World.Daily, and of course, part of our Twitter feed, you can track what he does as well. If the clouds cooperate tonight, skies all over North America will light up in just about an hour for a couple of hours in a very rare sight that has excited astronomers and so many other people. Experts say that this one-night-only phenomenon could produce a huge light show, or it could be a dud. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory noted that some forecasters are predicting about 100 meteors per hour, while others have much higher expectations, predicting more than 1,000 meteors an hour. Absolutely unbelievable. By the way, this weekend, the Starlight Festival in Big Bear in Southern California is going on. And if you're in that area, go out there because they have the greatest view for a meteor shower ever. So go take a look at that. It's a Starlight Festival in Big Bear in California. Now, I am sure tonight will generate UFO reports to the UFO Reporting Center, Peter Davenport's National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, would you agree?
Yeah, you're probably right. I'm dreading it already, George, and I'm torn between going out and watching the show myself or staying by the hotline and taking reports and trying to explain to people what they're looking at. But I just got back Wednesday from Oregon. Great to see you down in McMinnville.
Oh,
that was a wonderful get-together.
It sure was.
Look forward to more. Came back to just a mountain of reports, and I'll try to summarize some of them here very briefly. The day I left eastern Washington headed for McMinnville, a couple in Altoona, Idaho, at about 11 p.m. that Tuesday night, saw a red orb streak across Altoona from horizon to horizon, they say. Both of them very experienced, one of them a medical professional, and very, very nice report, very dramatic sighting. The next night, the 14th, I believe it was, of May, a young fellow was out walking in near Spirit Lake, Idaho, very rural area. 12:15 p.m., he saw an object that at first he thought was an eagle soaring over the lake, and it suddenly folded its wings, and it became elongated, and it streaked over the horizon. He says it disappeared from almost overhead to gone over the horizon in a matter of just a few seconds. Obviously not a raptor or any kind of soaring bird, which he thought it was at first. An interesting event in Hawaii on Tuesday night of this week. You've probably heard about it already. Apparently it was a missile launch, George. A missile launch of an Aegis anti-missile defense rocket. And I am prepared to accept that there was a launch, but we have received some interesting reports that there were lights seen before that missile was launched. And if we have, I'm sure we have many listeners in Hawaii. If anybody saw lights before the missile launch, I would welcome a report. And if anybody is a pilot out in Hawaii and has a notice to airmen, they would have had to issue what's known as a NOTAM, a notice to airmen, alerting them to the fact that there's about to be a missile launch. If anybody received one of those, or if they know anything about any kind of announcement the FAA made, I would welcome a report with all the facts they can provide me. And last night, Dardanelles, Arkansas, several reports of a white light, most of all from fishermen who are out on lakes and on rivers, saw a white light go from horizon to horizon in under 5 seconds, they report. Very, very dramatic sighting. We took several reports in rapid sequence. If it's not some kind of concerted or planned hoax, it must have been a very dramatic sighting. We would welcome any other reports from the Arkansas area. And tonight, we got a report from Kaiserslautern, I hope I pronounce it correctly, Germany, from a gentleman who I think is in the U.S. military forces over there. He and a group of people witnessed a cluster of objects for 25 minutes. They report they have no idea what they were. If we have any listeners over in Germany who may have seen those objects, we would also recommend they submit a written report. We'll post it with all the other reports we receive from Germany. So it's pretty busy, a lot of activity, and some bizarre objects are being reported to us by seemingly credible witnesses, George. So we'll keep reporting, and if anything unusual happens, I'll get in touch with Tom.
And Peter, I do have to tell you, you just did magnificently at the McMinnville UFO Festival. A lot of people don't know that you do this all on your own pocket, what's left in your wallet. So I want to give out, you do take donations for the National UFO Reporting Center. And honestly, you'll take $1, $2, $5, won't you?
Absolutely. So, whatever is convenient for people to give, it goes right into our bank account for paying telephone and internet fees and just direct expenses, everything but salary, and which we do not take. And if people would like to support us in our effort in trying to get the truth out to the American people and resisting the American government's foolish position on UFOs, we would welcome anything that they'd like to contribute. And thank you for saying so, George.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter. You do so much for us. Peter does not get paid in his appearances on this program. You can go to his website, ufocenter.com, ufocenter.com, and help him out a little bit. Up next, we are going to be talking about the unusual, a people's history of the peculiar, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Tonight, we're going to talk about the unusual, the strange, the bizarre. Nicholas Velardis with us. Nicholas is a historian, a writer. He's authored a couple very strange books. The one we're talking about, A People's History of the Peculiar, and Lords Part 1. Now, his journalism has appeared on the homepage of CNN and other news sites across America, and it's our pleasure to welcome Nicholas Velardis to Coast to Coast. Nicholas, you have an interesting mind, my friend. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. You know that meteor shower, did you see the name of that constellation where the meteor shower
is? It's bizarre, isn't it?
It's strange. Camelopardalis.
Yeah. I'm glad you pronounced it.
But it's also strange, too, because it's a constellation that's also known as the giraffe. So we got camels, we got giraffes, all in the same constellation. But that sounds like a wonderful light show tonight.
I'm going to make a prediction that when you were a little boy, you were interested in strange and unusual things.
I was. I was especially interested in maps. And while we have Google Maps nowadays, so it seems like everybody's interested in maps, I don't think it was very common for little kids to be so interested in maps, and I was reading novels at a young age. I think I was in second grade or third grade when I started reading a lot, which is a little unusual too, but maps, very, very much so.
When I was producing some television shows in Detroit in my early 20s, they used to call me Captain Bizarre, and they would call me that because I always liked to look for the very weird, strange stories that people would remember, as we used to say, at the water cooler the next day at the office. And reading your book, A People's History of the Peculiar, it just brought me back to my days in my little television shows, and you did a good job. How did you go about, Nicholas, collecting the stories for this book?
Lots of different ways. One of the ways was I was a historian for many years, and so I like data gathering research. I went to libraries just looking at source material that I'd seen maybe in graduate school or when I was teaching. So one of the ways is books. And then, of course, being a journalist, being comfortable with doing interviews just like we're doing right now, mm-hmm. calling somebody up and saying, hey, let me talk to you about something like Alice in Wonderland syndrome or something else. And so just digging in person to person, or digging in books, digging into the news. You know, that's a great way to find weird things to talk about.
Let's go through some of the aspects of the book, A People's History of the Peculiar, and we'll go through some of the things that you put together here. But as you put it together, was there anything of any particular interest to you?
Oh, boy. You know, I would have to say that because the nature of this book, and it has so many different categories in it, and I think we're only gonna, you know, we'll talk about a few categories tonight, but definitely the strange disease category, and of course the weird history category. But I'd say it's sort of a toss up between those two, because I'm just fascinated with disease, with biohistory, with disease being a cultural determinant for society. It's something that's talked about a little bit more in history circles today, but 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was kind of strange to say that disease could be a determinant for some historical event or something like that, like Napoleon losing Waterloo because of having a stomach ache or something like that would have been really strange to bring up, and would have been considered something more like psychohistory.
Mm-hmm.
But I think those things are becoming more accepted now.
The book is strange, well-written, strange. I mean, you've got the subjects in there on cannibalism and all the various aspects of the things that had happened. Some of them I remembered, like the Andes Mountain crash, but some of the others I had no idea. People have been eating people since the beginning of time, haven't they?
They really have, and you know, and that's where my journalism came in too, where I interviewed somebody who was a tourist who had gone to Fiji many times, and Fiji was known as the Cannibal Islands. And they came to me with a strange story, and they wanted mostly to be anonymous, but they were very willing to tell me that they'd met this elderly woman. Now, in Fiji and in the old myths, and what actually happened too, is that you would eat your enemies. If you conquered your enemies, you'd stew them up and eat them, and you'd get energy from that.
Jeez.
You would gain from it. And so, but that supposedly had been banned many years ago. And so this tourist on the island of Rotuma met an elderly woman who was doing her wash, and called this friend of mine over, and they developed a rapport and told her a story about a man who had committed some type of heinous crime. And that man had turned up missing. And this elderly woman, she kind of wanted to clear her conscience and tell this tourist friend of mine what happened, which of course was something, you know, just as heinous. But it goes back to conquering, eating your enemies, gaining energy from that. And this was only a few years ago, so we think the Cannibal Islands is something of the past, and Uter Uter's grave, something like that. No, this is something that perhaps still goes on if it happens in the right remote area, right?
Can't you get sick doing that?
I would think that, you know, some of the research that I've done before, and I think of Richard Preston, came out with a book, I can't remember the title of it, I'm thinking it was 10, 15 years ago, where he was talking about the equivalent of mad cow disease from eating people, and you get this astrogliasis of the cells, which means in your brain, your cells sort of explode and create these little pockets of just nothingness in your brain, this spongiform of the brain, and it causes you to lose motor functions, motor skills, and I know I don't know all the sicknesses from it, but it definitely, that's what mad cow disease does as well. It causes you to lose all kinds of motor functions, and pretty soon you just, you know, everything shuts down.
Yeah, well, it sure does. I think, was that The Hot Zone? Was that his
No,
book?
It was another book he wrote. He wrote a couple
he
of books.
He wrote a lot.
But the Hot Zone was the Ebola virus. That's what that one was.
Okay. Let's go through some of the things in the book, and you just tell us some of these stories as we get. And some of them are pretty darn old. I mean, did you have a difficult time finding them? What'd you do, go to libraries? How'd you dig it up?
Well, let's take a look at one of them. Let's look at, I had just a little blip from the Salem witchcraft trials, And I had studied witchcraft in early America in graduate school many years ago, and I remembered some of the sources that we used. In fact, there was one in particular. It was a collection of 17th century documents that was that had been gathered in 1864, and I remembered that book.
All right, hold on for a second. We'll get right into that in a second. Nicholas, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, I'll be in Scottsdale, Arizona tomorrow at the Earthkeeper event. Want full information on that? Simply go to our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. And if you're in the area, come on out. Going to have a great time. Richard Hoagland expected to be there, of course, for a major presentation as well. And welcome back to Coast. Nicholas Ballard is with us. We're talking about his work on people's history of the peculiar. Nicholas, we're talking about how you obtained all these stories, especially the older ones, and the clock goddess. So let's get back into that.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about the Salem witch trials, mm-hmm. which in the history section of the book, I talk about just a little bit from the maidservant Tituba being examined on the stand. And I go back to a 17th century collection of documents that I knew was gathered in a book that was actually printed in 1864. And, you know, there's, of course, there have been reprintings and that sort of thing. But you have to know where to kind of know where to look. You have to have an idea of how to data mine. But people would be surprised what kind of information are in their university libraries. If you live in a city where there's a university library, you could probably get a hold of some really interesting archival materials to look at for yourself. So that's a lot of what I did. And in regards to to Salem witchcraft, I just want to say a little something about history that, and to define it, which I think will really help the listeners of Coast to Coast, because oftentimes we look at the past, but we don't try to define the past. And I think that how historians think about the past in 2014 is not what historians will think about the past in 2114. And how you tell the story of the past is predicated on where you're looking from, which you could call the prism of the ever-changing present. But what's really important about history, and I think in especially with the Salem witch trials and what I included in the book, is that history is often considered as where the light illuminates. And of course, you know, we're talking about the historical record. Will there ever be more than a partial historical record? No, there's never going to be more than a partial historical record because only a little bit of our past has even been recorded. So that leaves George the darkness. That mm-hmm. leaves the what's unrecorded. That leaves things like the supernatural, which we could say, has the supernatural been recorded? Academics might say no. Some might say yes, and I suggest in this book that maybe a little bit of the supernatural has been recorded, regardless of what people say about the Salem witch trials, about whether there was a mass hysteria or class warfare going on. There's still a chill to when you read some of the original documents, because the maidservant Tituba starts saying things like, she's seen talking dogs, talking black dogs, talking hogs. She's talking about having been able to control birds so that they can attack these girls. She talks about flying on a stick, and she talks about a man, a tall man dressed in black, who has her sign a book. And I think that's a record possibly of the supernatural.
Sure.
Could it be of Tituba making it up? Well, what do you think, George?
That's very possible. By the way, back to Preston again. He was on our program about 17 years ago. And was it Panic in Level 4? Is that the book?
No, but I have the title right here. It's The Pathological Protein, Mad Cow, Chronic Wasting, and Other Deadly Prion Disease.
Okay. He was an expert on all that.
Yes. And The Hot Zone, which you mentioned as well, is a terrifying read. If your listeners have never read it, they need to go read it, because it's absolutely terrifying, especially since there's been an Ebola outbreak just within the last few weeks.
You talk about the fact that Christopher Columbus was the William Shakespeare of history. Tell me about this.
Well, I love what Winston Churchill says about Christopher Columbus. He says he's a riddle wrapped inside a mystery, inside an enigma. And I think that when when we think of Christopher Columbus, we may have only been exposed to Christopher Columbus through our high school or grade school education. So
right.
We might be thinking of Christopher Columbus, this guy's a hero. This guy's, you know, sailed the ocean blue. But what do we really know about him? And so in People's History of the Peculiar, I talk about, well, we don't know. We don't actually know where he was born. We don't know exactly when he was born. We don't know much about his family background. And this is what I'm talking about. History is where the light illuminates. Well, there's not a lot of light that illuminates the Christopher Columbus and his background. And I don't know if I just mentioned, but we don't know what he truly looks like as well. There are dozens and dozens of portraits that are made of Christopher Columbus, none of which he sat for.
Why is he so mysterious?
You know, that's a great question. And there's another thing, too. He's considered one of the historical figures in our time to bridge the gap between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance because of his four voyages to the New World. But there's another great mystery, too, which has to do with his most important voyage, which, by the way, Christopher Columbus didn't even admit he discovered a continent till his third voyage, which that's crazy enough. But in his first voyage, his ship's log, we lost the original. It gets quoted all the time, but it's not the original ship's log. In fact, the original ship's log was copied, and that was called, I believe, the Barcelona copy. And then a Dominican friar who was a friend of his family got a hold of the copy. And then he made a copy, but here's where it gets tricky, George, is we don't know if the Dominican friar embellished a lot of Christopher Columbus' first log. So and the Barcelona copy is lost. That one got lost. The original got lost.
Hmm.
So here's Christopher Columbus. That's why I call him the William Shakespeare of history, because he's, you know, like Churchill said, he's an enigma, in a mystery, in a riddle.
I'm going to throw some things your way. The mole people of Las Vegas.
There are urban legends, I think, in every city in America, and I'm almost certain that you've uncovered 90% of them
on this show. Yeah,
on this show, and you may have talked about the mole people before, and you know, in my explorations, I'm calling you right now from Bakersfield, California. From a house that used to be a morgue, so that's kind of interesting and creepy. And there are a few urban legends here. One, are there Chinese tunnels under Bakersfield, which used to be considered one of the largest Chinatowns in America? And as I've done research, I get the door shut in my face all the time trying to find the true answer to that. It's an urban legend. And then there's another urban legend, the one where I wrote in the novel Lords Part 1, which is about the Lords of Bakersfield. And if people want all the really creepy details of that, which is set in the 1970s, they can pick up that book. And so, but there's a story where I've done a lot of interviews and so forth, but it's still not proven. But the mole people of Las Vegas absolutely cannot be denied. In the last 10 to 15 years, it's been discovered that upwards of 1,000 to 1,500 people are living beneath the neon, beneath the city of Las Vegas. That's an incredible amount of people.
These are people who lost at the casinos, right?
I believe they're people who lost at the casinos. You know, here's a strange fact from it, George. Some of the people work in the casinos. Some of the people actually have jobs.
Really?
Some of these people have moved beds and shelves and couches below ground. But here's the thing, is there's over 400 miles of these tunnels beneath Las Vegas.
Natural tunnels or man-made?
No, man-made, and they're for what? Flash floods. So these are flood passages. So the people who've built underground, their beds are on pallets and crates. Their chairs are on pallets
and crates. So they float along because you are right. When it does rain hard in Nevada, and because of the desert and the hard sand and everything else, sometimes it just stays on top. I bet these folks could drown down there.
And there have been people who've drowned down there. In fact, some of the people down there tell ghost stories. So they already have their own urban legends. So about ghosts creeping in their tunnels. And there was a guy named Matthew O'Brien. He actually wrote a book called Beneath the Neon. And when I was living in Las Vegas in the late 90s, and I was working for the Fremont Street Experience as a writer for them, and Matthew O'Brien was just beginning his urban explorations, and he was writing for just a little newspaper, I think it was called Vegas City Life or something, and he was writing these little articles about his explorations, and he just kept going further and further and meeting more and more people.
That's amazing. Now in police, they don't do anything about these people living down there?
I don't believe they do. I don't think they chase them out at all, because there's been communities of people, and there's 400 miles of tunnels. You think the Las Vegas Metro Police Department probably don't have the manpower
no,
to deal with that.
I guess not. They seal them up or something.
Yeah, I mean, Las Vegas during this economic depression since 2009, 2008, something like that. Vegas was considered the most economically depressed city in the nation, and I spent a couple of months there, and the amount of homeless people above ground was amazing. So I can only imagine during that economic depression how the population of these mole people have grown beneath the neon, where there's access points even by some of the major casinos, George. Some of the major
casinos.
That's
amazing. How do they get down there? Where are the openings, Nicholas?
They are in what's called washes. So where the flash floods are expected to come washing through, there's access points all over the city.
Like a grate or something, you lift it up?
No, not even a grate. You lift up. It's like a wash that it's a depression in the dirt that's been. Some of them are man-made that are built, and you walk down into the depression, and you'll see a cement opening. It gets so bright in the desert, you can't see very far into these tunnel openings.
It's like a plug to a sink.
Exactly. And so you walk in, and after you've walked in maybe, 50 feet, you might see light behind you, but you better have all kinds of urban exploration gear if you're going to go searching in these places.
Now, do they have babies down there? I mean, a full type of existence?
I believe they do. I believe there are entire communities of people. I don't know if they actually have their babies down there, George, but I would be certain that there are children down there as well.
Well, they're living rent-free, aren't they?
Yeah. These people, and a lot of them, maybe they're working, and then maybe they still have an addiction problem. It could be a gambling problem. It could be a drug problem. And maybe there are some people who just prefer to live in an adventurous place. I mean, believe it or not, some people are just that adventurous.
We're talking about the bizarre with Nicholas Bilardis and his book, A People's History of the Peculiar. We'll take some of your calls with him next hour. Demi Moore, you said she had 45 leeches attached to her bod. Why?
You're not going to venture any guesses, George?
No. I'm going to let you handle it.
One of the areas of a people's history where I talk about all kinds of maladies and puzzling ailments, and there's a reality that people use obscure cures for whatever's bothering them. And we know now that we live in this age where, in fact, I was just talking about this today. If you think about Michael Jackson's plastic surgery that he had back in the 80s. Imagine how much plastic surgery has changed since then. And maybe he would have been reconstructed in a much different way if parts of him are reconstructed now. But you think about some of the wealthy people, and this isn't just wealthy people, but the Hollywood elite, you think, okay, might do something strange like, okay, I'm my blood is toxic. How Demi Moore finds out her blood is toxic, I don't know. But if she says her blood's toxic and she wants to go find a way to get some kind of enzymes to help her help her blood get enriched again, one of the natural ways to do it is to have leeches gorge on her blood.
I couldn't handle it.
I
see these movies, Nicholas, and these guys are in these rivers, in South America or something, on patrol, and they come out and they take their shirt off and they've got leeches all over it, and their buddies are scraping them off with a knife, and it's just horrible. I can imagine her putting 45 of these things on her.
That's just I don't think I can do it either. There's a park near here that has a stream, and I've seen little kids go tromping into the water and come out with leeches on their feet, and that's enough to terrify me. So I can't imagine 45 huge monstrous leeches, because that's how I imagine them, as giant monstrous leeches gorging on your blood just to get an enzyme to secrete into your body. And so I think a lot of people use some of the really bizarre, it's been known that some famous people drink urine because they think they're going to get some kind of wonderful qualities from that. And, you know, hey, more power to them, George, but I'm not going to do that.
No, I agree. Jeez. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about some of these incredible things that you uncovered. You talk about how laughter heals your stomach. Tell me about that.
Yeah, and that's another one. And you know, we live in. You were talking about what was going on in, I believe it's Portland, earlier on in the news portion that opened your show. And you know, I'm someone who has a lot of food allergies. I'm just going to admit it now. I do, and so there's a truth to the fact that. Laughter can help your stomach ache. There's just something to it. This isn't one of the pieces from my book where I go into great detail, but there's a reality to laughing. I mean, don't you feel good when you laugh? Don't you feel better when you laugh?
Everybody does.
Yeah.
And sometimes if you laugh too hard, it hurts your stomach. You ever had that happen?
Yeah, and supposedly it has a massaging effect on your intestines. So if you're having trouble going to the bathroom, go watch a funny movie. Like right now.
Yeah. Hey, you remind me a little bit of the late Charles Fort. You remember he wrote the Book of the Damned, but he had those kinds of stories too. Maybe you're a cross between him and Robert Ripley.
I'll take that.
You never know. But back to, you know, laughter does cure your stomach, does make you feel better. I think it does have some healing modalities to it, doesn't it?
It does, you know, and I haven't tried this. I don't get nosebleeds all the time, but supposedly if you run something really cold, like ice maybe, down the back of your neck, if you have a nosebleed, that sudden chills can cause blood vessels to contract and stop your nosebleed.
Huh. I didn't know that either.
So we have lots of these, and we have lots of these remedies in the book. If you're coughing, you can try a bar of chocolate. There's something in the cocoa that suppresses sensory nerves. If you get insect bites, mosquito bites, if you don't have any kind of anti-itch cream, try a dab of toothpaste. It might fight the swelling and the itching. So there's lots of home remedies that you can do.
You've got a chapter devoted to strange obsessions, odd occupations. They're fascinating.
There's one lady who does. Let's not even talk about her. Let's go to the guy who does wastewater management. Who we have these in every city in America. Wastewater management. And we don't think about what goes into the wastewater, or if we do think about what goes in, we're often concerned about what's toxic or what's not. And I talked to this guy, and he actually. He had a room or something at his work where they would take photos that people ripped up and threw down the toilet, and they kind of made a game of it. They would reconstruct photos.
Try to find the pieces, right?
Yeah, be careful what you put down.
Oh, I bet they find all kinds of things down there. We're going to come back in a moment with Nicholas and talk more about his... People's History of the Peculiar, and your calls on Coast to Coast AM.